Kevin Kelly was one of the co-founders of Wired magazine and served as its executive editor for 7 years. He also co-founded the All Species Foundation, which sought to catalog and identify every living species on Earth. And he's an active participant of the Long Now Foundation, which seeks to creatively foster long-term thinking and responsibility in the framework of the next 10,000 years. In his latest book, What Technology Wants, Mr. Kelly asks, where is technology taking us? And is a modern life full of technology natural? Is there a downside to it? The book is published by Viking Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Kevin Kelly to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
You research and write about technology all the time, but is it true that you don't have a television set in your home?
Yeah, we grew up with – my kids grew up without TV. And actually, when they were 22, the oldest one thanked us for not having TV in the house.
But a lot of people just have substituted the computer for a TV.
We had the internet and Netflix. Mm-hmm. So we saw probably the best of what was on there without the worst.
But that was that because you chose not to have a TV and then you had to make an adjustment, or
no? It was
because you're a technology guy.
It was intentional from the beginning. It was this idea that you wanted to be able to have control over what you do. So I believe in taking sabbaticals from technology. I believe in keeping it at arm's length some of the time. I mean, other times fully diving into it.
Let's talk about some of your other projects. What's the Encyclopedia of Life?
This began as a campaign to try and figure out, to catalog, what organisms are alive on Earth. It turns out we don't know. We have no idea. And we have identified maybe 1.7 million of them, but we don't have any idea whether the total number is 5 or 10. And so I did a campaign to see if we could catalog those.
Well, we keep on finding new ones. At the same time, any number are going into extinction on a regular basis.
Yes. And so we have some extinctions. We have about 200 species that we've identified that have been extinct in the last 2,000 years. But we suspect there's more, but we can't really tell unless we know how many there are in total. And so this is what we don't know.
You've also worked on the 10,000-year clock, one of the many projects led by the Long Now Foundation. What's the 10,000-year clock? And I'm not going to be around all that much. In fact, I'm not going to be around more than, I don't know, 20, 30 years.
Yes. The clock is an actual clock that will tick. It'll kind of tick once a year, talk once a century, and every 1,000 years a little cuckoo will come out. And the idea is to have – once you have a clock that ticks for 10,000 years, you can begin to think about 10,000-year scale projects. You can think about long-term civilization. You can think about something beyond the next quarter. So it's a way to encourage people to think long-term.
But didn't the Mayans come up with a long-term calendar? There is no Mayan civilization anymore.
There's nothing to say that this civilization will continue, but – we do believe that while we're here, we act better when we think long term.
Is that clock available to the general public?
There is a prototype in the London Science Museum, and there is another clock one being built right now in Texas. And eventually the 40-foot size clock will be built inside some property we own inside a national park on the top of a mountain in Nevada that's surrounded by bristlecone pines, which are, of course, the longest-lived organisms on Earth.
Were you applying the Long Now sensibility in the way that you opened the book? Why is it necessary to go back to the Neolithic era in order to discuss technology?
Well, you know, we have all the stuff in our pockets or surrounded by things in the city. We have technological infrastructure that's completely in our swimming pools, in our backyards, in our offices and bedrooms, but we don't know what technology is. We don't really know what the thing is. And so I want to stand back and say, if we look at the history of where it came from, can we start to identify what is it that what we mean by technology?
Well, we do know that it's been around a long time. But I get the sense that you're arguing that we've only gone wrong recently with things like television sets and MP3 players.
We tend to define technology as anything that was invented after you were born, or maybe anything that doesn't work yet. But obviously, most of the technology in our lives was invented long before we were born. This table, the chair, all this stuff was invented long. So we in our minds, we kind of think it's all the new stuff, but actually most of the stuff is old. And we're kind of distracted by the new. We want to know about it. And I want to know, well, where did it come from and so?
Well, we are fascinated by the development of the arrowhead and of the flint that can be used as a knife. But when you look through the history of humans, those things remain pretty stable for thousands and thousands of years. Now everything changes every 2 seconds.
That's true. But what's interesting is that you can still buy a brand new chert, bladed, antler-boned, handled knife that's made in exactly the same way as it was 50,000 years ago. And what I figured out by doing some research is that there's almost no technology that has disappeared. It's all still going. So this is what we get. We have the old options as well as the new options.
Are those good knives?
There
should
are.
Should I have one in my kitchen?
There. If you know how to keep it sharp.
You coined the word technium. What does that mean?
I was interested not in the individual gadgets that we have, not in the individual technologies, but I was interested in the whole ecosystem of all this stuff because it appeared to me very clearly that the power of it was not them as individual standalone items, but when they were connected together. So the little device that you have in your pocket requires at least 10,000 other technologies to make it. There's no single human that can make it on their own. And so that network of interdependencies creates something in itself, and that something in itself, which is what I call the technium, has its own tendencies and urges.
It has what you call a self-amplifying nature.
It is. One of the things that technology wants is to make more technology, in case we haven't noticed that. It wants to make the world more susceptible to new technology. It wants us to feed it. And so that's selfish in some ways.
But then we have something like the alphabet, which can be called a self-amplifying technology, can't it?
That's right. The more people that read, the more that we make words, the more necessary it is to read. And so in that way, it is a selfish technology.
Well, in this view, did the technology of the violin self-amplify into iTunes?
Yes, it was all part of a natural progression. And this is something that surprised me when I did the research, which is that technologies in their progression are inevitable. So if we could hypothetically rewind the tape of civilization, we would find upon rerunning it that many of the same inventions would come up again and again.
Is it just inventions? For example, thinking about art history, wouldn't Cubism have evolved even if Cézanne had lived?
Absolutely.
Or something similar? An abstract art would have come along, maybe not the year that Kandinsky did it, but a couple of years later?
Absolutely. And we know from the kind of contests and arguments in the arts where people say, well, no, I invented that or invented that before you. You stole my idea. Simultaneous invention is the norm for both technology and art.
And we were talking earlier about the fact that calculus was invented the same time by two people who – great people, brilliant men – who didn't know the other one was doing it.
The numbers of examples, the telephone patents were filed within 3 hours of each other. The light bulb was invented by 23 other people, and Edison was basically the last first inventor of the light bulb.
So why does he wind up with the credit for the invention?
Marketing. He had also a bunch of other inventions before him. He most importantly invented not just the light bulb but the electrical system that powered the light bulb.
So is this just a matter of synchronicity?
No, this is a matter of inevitability. This is the matter of the fact that when things are in the air, if you don't invent it, someone else will.
This is something that Malcolm Gladwell has written about. Hasn't the zeitgeist always led to change?
Change is what is the natural state of humanity. We're people who made ourselves to change even faster than we are.
My guest is Kevin Kelly. His latest book, What Technology Wants, is published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say that you agree with the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski's notion of technical necessity. I hope you don't agree with the way that he attempted to correct the problem.
No, not at all. He was a serial murderer, and but he was right, and as are many other technology critics, that the technium as a whole has an agenda. He was wrong about what it was. He believed that the agenda of the technium was to take away his freedoms, when in fact, in most every case, what the technium and technology brings us is increasing choices and options.
But one of the problems, it seems to me, is that we trust it so much. For example, there are many people who will tell you, oh, we'll just come up with some technological way to get around the problem of fossil fuels or of climate change or some of the other really big issues. They just trust technology to take care of it, so who cares?
So most of the problems in our lives today are technogenic. They're actually created by technology, because each time technology creates a solution, it's also creating a problem.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be dependent on fossil fuels.
Exactly. However, I think the proper response to a bad idea is not to stop thinking. It's to have a better idea. The proper response to bad technology is not to have no technology or to reduce it, but to have better technology. So the proper response to something like that is actually to have a better technology. It will make new problems itself, but the answer is always going to be, let's make it even better.
But there, it all requires a human interaction. You can't – technology cannot develop by itself, no matter – how brilliant the idea, and there have been scientists who have come up with brilliant ideas that have just sat there until somebody figured out how to apply them.
An idea can be too far ahead of its time, and unless it's really the next logical step, it really isn't very useful. That's why there's an inevitable progression of technologies. And so the human cloning, for instance, is inevitable. The internet was inevitable. What was not inevitable is what kind of internet we would have or what kind of human cloning we're going to have. That's a choice that we have. And we can make it either more convivial or not. We can make it more open or not. We can make it more centralized or decentralized, whether it's flexible or adaptable. That's the choice that we have, and it makes a huge difference for us.
Well, you say we have that choice. I've inherited the situation of network, radio and television and all the other things that constitute the media. This isn't anything that I have in control over. If I were reinventing it, I would reinvent it quite differently.
You do have choices.
And other countries have done it differently.
You have choices in terms of whether you want to buy your music on iTunes or go out onto the net and download it for free. Your choices actually does influence the development of the next stage of technological evolution.
Well, unfortunately, too many people are just going and taking things for free.
So that's where it's going to go.
And that's why record companies are going out of business.
Exactly.
And is that a good thing?
That's what technology wants. We have to understand that oftentimes we have to listen to technology and hear what it wants. And what it wants is actually ubiquity.
Well, you're saying something like what technology wants suggests that technology has a mind of its own.
It doesn't have a mind of its own, but does have its own urges. In the same way that a plant might lean towards the light, that's not because it has a mind. It's just because that system has an urgency, a tendency towards the light. The technium is maybe this equivalent of a plant that wants to bend in certain directions. And I am asking the question, well, what directions does it want to bend to?
You show the parallels between the evolution of living things, the six kingdoms of nature, and the evolution of technology you propose should be a seventh kingdom. How is the technium similar to nature?
If you look at the general long-term trends of what's operating within technology, its drive towards greater complexity, greater diversity, greater specialization, greater energy density, those are exactly the same drives that move through evolutionary biology. So in a certain sense, we can say that technology is basically evolution extended and accelerated.
So it follows the lines of Darwinian logic?
Well, Darwinian logic is not the only logic that runs through evolution. In fact, one of the things I show is, in fact, that evolution in biology has a direction.
And things become extinct along the way.
In biology, things become extinct. In technology, they don't become extinct.
They don't. So that's why we still have that old flint knife.
That's right. I actually did a – I took a challenge to take a catalog page from the 1898 Montgomery Ward catalog to see how many of those archaic agricultural implements were extinct. And I could find every single one of them manufactured new today.
In a slightly altered version.
No, exactly the same.
Jenny in Tarrytown says human technology has grown exponentially over the last several thousand years, but human beings themselves are much the same as they've been since the Stone Age. How is all this complex gadgetry affecting our hunter-gatherer brains?
It's altering them tremendously. We know from brain studies that literacy has rewired our brains, that people who are literate think differently than the people who don't read and write. And so obviously our brains are being rewired. We have remade ourselves from the very beginning. We invented something called cooking, which is an external stomach. That changed the nutrient in our bodies, which altered our teeth and our jaws. So our invention changed us biologically. We're actually evolving faster now than 10,000 years ago.
So you're saying technology is a step in the evolutionary process?
Yes. We are remaking ourselves, and that is – so we ourselves are the first technology. We're the first animal that we domesticated.
But this is an odd thing. We're both creator and creation existing equally in the same system.
And that's why the tension in technology will never leave us, because while it's selfish, it's also generous. And the fact that sometimes we would do what technology wants and sometimes we have to do what we want, that tension is always going to be there as long as there's technology.
You're right that cameras are extensions of our eyes. Cooking serves as an external stomach. What are contemporary technologies like the computer and the internet an extension of our brains?
Yes, some people call it the exobrain. And some of us are a little worried maybe that we've become too dependent on it. But actually, if you think about how dependent you are on the alphabet, we're not really all that, you know, we don't get bent out of shape by the fact that we think in terms of words and we rely on the alphabet for how we think. But I don't think we're going to be that upset that we depend on technology to increase our memories. That's just something we'll accept.
Will you explain how the Pentium chip, that little piece of silicon inside the computers, is more energetically active than the sun or the human brain?
That's one of the trends of what technology is moving, just like biological evolution is, which is getting more and more energy dense.
Well, isn't this the stuff of science fiction, the point where we rely on technology to do our thinking for us, and of course, then Hal goes crazy because there's always a certain possibility in sentient beings, or I'm assuming by extension, machines, to go haywire.
Yes, well, I mean, we live with 6 billion other intelligences that can go haywire, so we have some experience in dealing with people who are minds that go haywire. So it's nothing new, really.
So Hal just needs a good psychoanalyst and everything will be okay?
Well, not everything okay for us, maybe not for him.
Kevin Kelly helped launch Wired magazine, was its executive editor for its first 7 years. He has written for various publications and also a number of books. His most recent is What Technology Wants. It's published by Viking. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Kevin Kelly, his book, What Technology Wants. It's published by Viking. And I've been hoping that somebody will invent a machine that will prevent me from misreading things. Is that possible?
Yes, I think you just have to live long enough.
You compare our ongoing attachment to technology with drug addiction.
Some people do. I think it's not a very good explanation about why we keep coming back to technology if it really is as bad as some people claim it is. I think that the metaphor of addiction actually doesn't work very well.
So you don't like that crackberry thing?
No. I think that we're actually smarter than that. I think we weigh – and we know what the costs are, and we know what the benefits, and we actually figure out that the benefits outweigh the costs.
Although there are people who do seem to be addicted. There's always that person in front of me at the theater or the movie theater who cannot turn off his BlackBerry or his iPhone.
I think there certainly are stages of infatuation, and just as there are in our lives with other things. And so there may be periods of times when people become really dependent on it, but I don't think it's long term.
Well, I was hoping that cell phones would never get any smaller. The first one was big as a quart of milk. But the evolution of technology also seems to show a pattern of getting smaller and smaller.
In some things, although we're actually making the largest things that we've ever made before, which are cities, which are a technology too, by the way. So we're expanding both the limits of the small and the large at the same time.
You have a blog, don't you, called Cool Tools, which features a new gadget of interest every day?
It does.
And you have a new one 365 days a year?
Well, actually 5 days a week, but it's close. So the idea is this is a crowdsource blog. It's not ones that I'm writing. But there is an editor involved, and what we're doing is we're selectively saying, this is worth your while. This is a recommendation.
Now, if you had been doing it for the last 50 or 60 years, could you have come up with as many? Has it sped up? I'm thinking of that because today is the anniversary of the release of the first transistor radio in 1954. And I remember ballpoint pens around that time. They just seemed like a miracle.
Yeah, and of course what the transistor was replacing was the vacuum tube radio where you take your little tube down to the neighborhood shop to check to see if it was good or not. And the idea that there would be a radio as small as a pack of cigarettes was astounding. Of course, now radios are as small as a period on the end of a sentence.
And is that a positive thing? Is a movement away from large physical objects a signal of long-term progress?
It is one of the things that we see is that there is an ongoing intangibility in direction in evolution in the universe. The universe began as matter, as energy, then became matter, and now it's in our local area being dominated by information, which is kind of intangible. So there is kind of the overthrow of the material in this direction of evolution.
Is that how you would describe progress?
I think progress is a bunch of things, but the main component of progress, I believe, is the increasing options and opportunities and possibilities that it brings us in the world. So we see more varieties of things, we see more kinds of things, and most importantly, we see the evolvability of evolution changing itself.
Does progress require an ever larger population to increase the ability to process information?
Among humans, we have no experience with increasing living standards without increasing population. We have plenty of examples.
But we talk about a population explosion. Malthus was worried about that.
Right.
And that's a long time ago.
So in natural biological evolutions, when you have Malthusian explosions, it turns into just disaster. But the difference is that humans have science. And so science has actually flipped the power of population explosions to unleash ideas. And so we have ideas and the market for ideas and the appetite for ideas. And so what we have is with exploding populations is actually we have exploding progress.
But we also talk about whether we can sustain it, whether our resources can keep up with that population explosion.
Right. That's the real crucial question. What is the capacity of the planet to sustain that kind of population? And the answer is that we don't know. But one of the things that I do know from the history of technology is that it's not anti-life. It turns out if you want to do high technology making silicon chips, you actually need very, very clean water. So we can say in a certain sense that technology wants clean water just like we do.
One of our listeners, Amy in Manhattan, asks, is there any way to promote green techs getting what it wants in the face of the predominance of polluting technologies? I think you partly answered that just now. In fact, how much is it a question of the technologies getting what it wants and how much of people with lots of money having the means to promote what they want to keep getting more money and power under the system as it currently exists? She must be thinking about the Koch brothers.
Yes. I think there is an aspect in which technology wants more of itself and is using itself to – and using other people's money to actually increase its own self. So I think that is happening, and we have to be aware that that is part of what technology wants. But at the same time, there's no technology that we've made so far that we cannot imagine a more greener version. So there is – it is compatible with life.
But then whenever we promote – or propose a greener version, there are those critics who say it's too expensive. It never seems to be too expensive to develop the latest iPad.
And so the solution always is a better technology that's not as expensive and is just as green, and we can do that too.
How does technology constrain itself over time?
technology is constrained by the physics of chemistry and material goods, and it can't just do anything. So it's going to be channeled by certain things. For instance, if you want to lift up something high in the sky, it's going to require a certain amount of energy always, no matter what happens.
And this is what happened when people tried to come up with fusion energy. They were constrained by the fact that it doesn't seem to be possible, at least at the moment.
Cold fusion.
Yeah,
is,
cold fusion.
But hot fusion is probably be very likely.
But do we have the capability to do it now?
Yes.
So why aren't we doing it?
Oh, we are doing it. They're at Lawrence Livermore and a couple other places, they're working with laser fusion, which has great promise, but of course it's had great promise for 40 years. The sun does it, so we know it's possible. This is what happens in the sun. So the sun's doing it 24 hours a day all the time. So we know that fusion is possible. Whether it can be possible on a small scale is a different story.
But we at least as we now understand it, we cannot travel faster than the speed of light.
Yes.
There are certain things that do constrain us.
Exactly. So you don't want to hope on that one. But there's so many things between that and there that we're coming along that we will change our lives, that will make us more interesting and more full of possibilities.
Can we talk about Moore's Law in this regard?
Moore's Law is a law that has proven true in the past 30 or 40 years, where the power of computers has doubled and the costs have halved every 18 months. It's on like a straight line. And that kind of powers our ideas about progress these days.
And we're using technology to come up with these new innovations. Is it correct to say that technology continually improves itself?
Yes, it is. It's a self-amplifying system, and that's in one way that I would say it has its own agenda.
Well, so we wind up with something like the hard disk, and then we improve on that?
And it gets smaller and smaller. I did a calculation that all the music in the world that's ever been recorded can fit onto one hard disk, one 6-terabyte hard disk that costs $500 from Amazon. So you could have the entire library of music on your desktop, and next year it'll be in your pants pocket.
Really? I mean, I remember it wasn't all that long ago when the CD was invented, and the amount of information on it, the Japanese inventors decided, should be the length of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
But that's how fast things are moving. And the question, of course, is once you have all the music in the world in your pocket, what are you going to listen to next? That's a hard
I could just see somebody on the subway going through that iPod. Oh, I only have 10 million more to choose from.
It's a hard problem.
My guest is Kevin Kelly, whose latest book is What Technology Wants. It is published by Viking. Has there been a discernible direction in the evolution of technology?
There has been. And that direction is from the general to the specific. So we start off with the kind of a camera. Then we make specialized cameras. We start off with a hammer. We make specialized hammers. We start off with a chip. We make specialized chips. The move from simple to complex, the move from one thing to diverse things, the move from a single to ubiquity. There's a number of different drives that are pushing evolution towards greater and greater choices and possibilities.
But I want to get back to that idea of what technology wants. Isn't saying the technium wants something the same as saying that the Ford assembly line wants a Model T?
It's not quite the same. I'm not assigning it intelligence or consciousness. I'm saying that there is a tendency in any system to bend in certain directions. And in this case, you could say that the system, once it's set up, if it was made to produce these things, yeah, it does want it. But it's not a conscious want. In the same way, we could say a poppy seed wants to be a flower. You know, even though it's on a bagel, it wants to be a flower, even though there's nothing conscious about that.
Well, once Ford comes up with the assembly line, then people see all sorts of other possibilities for it. And for a while, it horrified everybody. We have Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. And we do have people who had really rough times on the assembly line, probably even today, where they're expected to handle so many calls on some kind of a computer service program. So these have positive and almost anti-human impacts at times.
Yeah, I think the progression of technology is maybe a little bit like a person. They went through various stages, and I think there was sort of a terrible two stage of technology where it was kind of inhumane and a little bit brutal and dirty.
That's with the Industrial Revolution.
That's the Industrial Revolution. And I think we've been through that, and now we're seeing a more adolescent or more mature version of technology where it can be a little bit more humane, a little bit more organic, a little bit more to our scale.
What about people who reject technology? The Amish, for example, how do they interact with technology?
People think of the Amish as sort of Luddites, where they're kind of against all technology. But in fact, my experience hanging out with them is that they are completely in love with it, but they're just very selective about what they choose. And what's interesting about the Amish is that, unlike the rest of us, they choose collectively, and they have a very specific criteria for what technologies they allow in their lives. And they are technologies that encourage their family to work together and bind their communities together. So they found that, in fact, things that we normally wouldn't think of as appropriate, like genetically modified corn, is something they want because it helps them keep the family farm together, because it requires less high-tech machinery to harvest than does corn that's been ravaged by corn borer. So they don't have zippers, but they have disposable diapers. They don't have cars, but they've got rollerblades. They don't have landlines, but they have cell phones. And so they make very conscious choices to maximize their lifestyle.
So it doesn't sound all that different from you deciding to have a computer but not a television set.
I think of ourselves as neo-Amish. The difference is that we make our decisions individually and they make it collectively.
But it, to some degree, it almost sounds hypocritical what they have chosen. And And I know somebody who also has friends in the Amish community, and she says there's always a payphone down the road.
There is. And in fact, they have little booths where they share it, and they don't own cars, but they rent cars. They rent drivers. They make a distinction between owning and renting. They go to the library to use the internet. There's Amish websites run off of libraries. So they're no more hypocritical than really we are. It's just that they accept the fact that they can keep at a distance.
I just saw an eye-opening documentary about the windmills that generate electricity. Their electric companies are renting farmland in upstate New York. It's different than when they do them out in the oceans. A lot of towns thinking, this is great, we want to promote green. And then they discover that they have this 400-foot high tower, lots of them, in their area. They're rather dangerous. Some of them, sometimes they fall down. The blades are bigger than a jumbo jet. And they make a lot of noise. They cast shadows. You have the strobe effect in your home 24 hours a day. And now they're fighting it and they're being called Luddites.
Right. Every new technology will create problems. And there is no technology that does not bite back. That's a part of the techno literacy that we have to educate ourselves in. Is that there's a cost, including the cost for supposedly green technology. So we have to weigh those in balance. And I think if we expect that there's a silver bullet that, whether it's fusion or wind power or solar power, solar cells use rare earth metals. They're very toxic.
And right now, as it was pointed out in Paul Krugman today, pretty much dominated by the Chinese because the United States stopped being interested in it and ceded all control of rare metals to the Chinese. Now they have 96% or 98% of the market.
So even that aside, there's always going to be a cost to new technologies, and we have to acknowledge that. That's why the idea of the precautionary principle, which says that we can't use a new technology unless it's proven 100% safe, is just crazy. There's no way to do that.
There's another aspect of all of this story, and that is you can't predict.
Right.
For example, the movie or the book, and then the movie 2001 had a computer that was huge. Well, by 2001, that computer in a space station would have been no bigger than your book.
Almost no inventor has any idea what's going to happen with his or her invention. Thomas Edison, when he was inventing the phonograph, made a list of what he thought it was going to be used for. At the top of the list was his idea that you record the dying words of the people who were dying, their last words. And he had some other ideas, and number 10 at the bottom was, oh, maybe someone will use it to record music. So even he didn't have any idea what the phonograph was for.
Well, that's because it then you have the technology and then it satisfies some kind of a need. But technology's trends and directions seem to coincide with the course of human events, don't they?
Yes, and the only way to find out about technology is to use it. This is one of the things I want to stress in this book is that only through use, by becoming intimate with it, by embracing it, can we really gain the full benefits of technology.
Kevin Kelly will be giving a talk at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs today at 5:30. That's on East 64th Street. And then at 8, he'll be speaking with Robert Krulwich and an earlier guest on our show, Stephen Johnson, at the New York Public Library on 42nd Street. For tickets to either of those events, go to our show page at WNYC.org. And he'll be talking about the ideas that are in his latest book, which is called What Technology Wants. It is published by Viking. And I want to thank you, Kevin Kelly, so much for being on our show today.
It's an honor. Thanks for your great questions.